So, Brittany, thanks so much for coming back.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to converse with you, Seamus.
I saw that you hit the end of Half-Life 2, Episode 2, and I knew I had to have you on again. I saw your posts on Twitter when you got to the ending and went through what everybody else went through a few years ago, and I knew we had to talk about it.
I'm glad that I have you as kind of a support group for these horrible endings of games that I hit. It really helps when I end one. Oh, thank God I can talk to Seamus about it.
So, just to get us started, for context, for anybody that hasn't played it but wants to know what we're talking about, can you describe it and your reaction?
The ending of episode 2, you mean?
Yeah.
Right, okay, so, the ending of episode 2, I guess the short version is, so, the base that has the rocket that's going to close the giant portal that was created by the destruction of the Citadel. Striders are coming to attack that base. You have to stop them. So there's this big, for me it was very difficult, final boss fight against these Striders. You blow them all up, you win, everybody cheers, hooray, okay, great. So you go back, you get a really cool scene where you get to watch the rocket launch and close the portal, and everybody cheers, and that's wonderful, hooray! But there's still the problem of the Borealis that was established before the boss fight. Somewhere up in the Arctic, Judith Mossman has said there's this ship that's got some technology on it, and you don't really know a whole lot about it, but you know that you and Alex have got to go there, you've got to stop the Combine from getting it. So you head off to this helicopter that's going to fly you to the Arctic. Okay, great. And that is where I assumed the game was going to end, because I knew, you know, it's impossible to have any, you know, exposure to gamer culture and not know that episode 2 ended on a cliffhanger. Like, I couldn't avoid that spoiler.
You knew you weren't going to get closure, but you didn't really understand the scope of the problem.
Right. I knew there wasn't going to be plot closure, and that's what I assumed it was. I assumed, okay, we're going to get on the helicopter, we're going to fly off into the sunset towards the Arctic, and that's going to be it. And, you know, that's a shame that we never got to play that next chapter, but, you know, okay, whatever, no big deal. But that is not, in fact, how it ends. It ends with the, I'm derping, what's the name of the grub? The Overseers, right. As you're getting ready to get onto the helicopter, the Overseers bust in through the barn that your helicopter is landed in, just murder Eli in the most horrible possible way in front of both you and Alex. And then Dog shows up and chases.
Yeah, right.
Alex being Eli's daughter. She just gets murdered. And the worst part is it's not just murdered. It's like murdered in such a way that Valve just like literally grabs your heart and just twists it in the worst possible way where Eli is literally, I think the line is he literally goes, "Don't look, baby. Don't look." And then he just gets
shanked. He knew it was about to happen, and he didn't want his daughter to see this thing suck the brains out of his skull. Oh,
right.
So right. Gruesome.
And then that happens, of course. And then, fortunately, Dog, because Dog is, of course, awesome, shows up, jumps on the Overseer, and scares them away. So they run away. And that releases you and Alex, because it looked like Alex was just about to be next. And in that moment, I literally thought, I swear to God, if I have to watch Alex die right here, I'm Alt-F4ing. I don't even care. I'm done.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I didn't have to watch her die, because that would have really upset me even more. But so the Overseers run away. Alex runs up to the body of her father, which is now, one assumes, a husk with all of the juice sucked out of it, or whatever the Overseers do. And of course, is just sitting there sobbing uncontrollably over him, begging him not to be dead. And that's where it fades to black and the credits roll. Oh my god, I was so mad. I was so mad, Seamus. If my computer right. wasn't as big as it is, because I've got one of those giant, like, 20-pound cases, it would have gone through my window.
Yeah. Oh. Oh, that's a shame. I wish your computer was lighter. No, wait, no, I wish this game didn't end on that. And, yeah, I kind of went through a similar thing. Everybody talked about the cliffhanger, and I just thought lack of closure. And to a certain extent, the games have always been about that. They kind of always end with, but then what happens next? Tune in next right. time. And but this was an emotionally powerful moment that demanded follow-up. This wasn't just a, and what happens next? How do our heroes get out of this situation? It's just this horrible gut punch that the story can't end there. Because the story isn't about the death of Eli. The story of Half-Life isn't the story about how Eli dies. So the story can't end there because that doesn't make any sense as an ending.
Right. I would have been totally okay with my original assumption of them getting into a helicopter and flying away. Like, yeah, that would have been mildly disappointing to know there was no follow-up, but the lack of emotional closure is the painful part of this, not the plot. The plot's whatever. You can make up whatever happens on the Borealis, but you can't just leave Alex there sobbing over Eli's body for 10 years. Like, that's not okay. Right. In no universe is that an okay thing to do.
Right, and Valve just sort of assumed, and then we'll make another one, and then they didn't. And it's like, well, if you don't have the other one, if you aren't sure you're going to make the next one, then don't do stuff like that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how popular of an opinion this would be, but my personal take on it is, I understand what they were trying to do with that. But I'm of the mind, storytelling-wise, you just don't end a story there, period. Like,
yeah,
you just don't. Like, if it has to end with him dying, like, okay, I get that. So he's got to die for the story, fine. But you don't fade out on that moment. You fade out later, when Alex and Gordon get on the helicopter and fly off into the yeah. sunset.
And talk about what this means and what they're going to do next. You give
right,
us the,
and we're going to go do yeah. this for Eli or whatever.
Exactly. Fading out on that moment just means that this can't be the end. It doesn't make any sense to stop the story here. And it doesn't work as any... It's an unsatisfying ending for a story, even if there was another game coming. That's
exactly.
just not a good it's just not a good place to end your story because it doesn't give the player closure on this one. And you know, it's okay to set things up for the next one and make them curious, but kind of end the story that we're having. And yeah,
absolutely. They I mean, because yeah. like even the Lord of the Rings movies, I mean, they don't fade out on those moments at the end of a movie, right? You fade out on moments that are like, okay, God, what's going to happen next? You know, oh, God, the Fellowship is broken up. Frodo and Sam are going off by themselves. But you don't fade the credits on Boromir's death.
Right, exactly.
No, that would be stupid.
It doesn't make any sense, and it confuses the movie because then it feels like it's a movie about Boromir mm-hmm. if you end there, mm-hmm. and it, of course, isn't, so that doesn't make any sense as an ending, and you're like, what is the storyteller trying to do here? This doesn't make any sense.
Right, it feels cheap, is what it feels like. It cheapens yeah. every bit of that emotional moment. By trying to use it to twist the knife. And that's just not necessary. It's just not. You don't need to do that, Valve. You're better storytellers than this.
Right. I can understand other hacks in this industry. Like, well, we got to get using cliffhangers as a marketing tool. Well, if we just make the ending enough of a cliffhanger, they'll give us another $60 2 years from now.
Right.
But you don't need to do that if people are into the story and just want to spend more time with the characters. Valve didn't need to do this.
And there's a difference between emotional cliffhangers and plot cliffhangers. And you should never end a story on an emotional cliffhanger. Ever.
Yeah.
That's my opinion really anyway. Never. It's just so mean.
I know, it is mean, and I think kind of irresponsible to end the story like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly,
given other games have been canceled or changed, or even if they were making another one, do you know that it will be this same team? Do you know that, you know, the next person is going to be able to continue from this moment? You need to be very sure you can continue the next game where you left off if you're going to end on something like this. And of course, video games take years to make. You can't do that unless you're doing like a Peter Jackson thing where you're just making them all at one time like a crazy person. I suppose then you... But even then, it just you don't end it on an emotional note like that because it's, irresponsible. You don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah, this is me completely shaking my head in agreement. It's just wrong. I mean, that might be an overused and overblown word to use, but I genuinely think that when you ask someone to invest their heart and their mind in your story and to trust you with that, it's wrong to abuse it like that. And that's kind of how I felt at the end of this. I felt like my trust and my heart that I had invested in this story for however many years had been completely abused and betrayed. And all they had to do was add two more minutes of it and not fade out on that exact moment. That's all they had to do. Like,
right.
I don't know, man. Far be it from me to tell Mark Laidlaw, who's one of my favorite authors, how to write. But fuck, dude. Come on.
Right. What were you thinking, man? Just, I think just another couple of minutes would have helped everything. Just to show Alex recover from that moment so that she's not stuck in our minds forever sobbing over her father.
Exactly. I do wonder how much of that was Laidlaw's actual decision, though. I mean, we will never know, I'm sure, the internal politics or the writing and storytelling breakdown of who exactly decided what. But I do... My heart wants to excuse him so much from that and hope that he argued against it and just didn't really get a choice.
Yeah. And I guess they were still believing. Like, at that point, they were probably still thinking, and then we'll just make another episode and it'll be out in a couple years. But the rot had already set in. They were already like, yeah, we're going to come out with this every year. Well, it's going to be every 2 years. Well, every... few years. Well, actually never. Like they just kept slipping. And I think they must have been aware that their plan to just come out with this continuous flow of episodes wasn't working by the end of two. Like, two kind of grew and got away from them a bit, and it kind of, two almost, by modern standards, two qualifies as a full video game.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, yeah. It's like not an episode, it's just a game. And then they started thinking about Half-Life 3 as a whole game and not another episode. And yeah, by the end of 2, they had to realize that their whole idea of rapid episodes wasn't working. And they probably should have taken that into account before they wrote the ending to this one. Even aside from the cliffhanger, they should have been thinking about, you know, what are we going to be doing next with this story? Are we moving to a new engine? Because they were in the middle of making a new engine.
Wow, I actually didn't know that. I know very little about the actual, what actually happened at the time. I only know the games, you know, as they are
right.
Now.
Well, they're a little weird about how they did the engine. The engine, I'm talking about Source Engine 2, they used in Left 4 Dead was, I think that was the first title that used it. And you could see Left 4 Dead, I don't know if you've played it, but you can see it's a good graphics, it's a good solid graphics generation ahead of the Half-Life games. Just faces are more expressive, everything's more detailed, a lot more went into animations and things, and a lot more lighting effects. And, you know, there's got to be the question there, when you're writing the end of Half-Life 2 Episode 2, certainly this engine's being worked on, and, you know, you're asking yourself, well, is the next episode going to be in that engine? Shouldn't we decide that? Because that adds a lot of questions to your... If you move to the new engine, then that's all new character models, and then you're talking about making a whole new game and not just more episodes. You're not just making, you know, new levels for the content you already have. You're kind of starting over with new content. So... I guess the point I'm meandering towards is that by the end of making episode 2, they should have been aware. I think they were probably aware that their fast, rapid-fire episode idea wasn't working, and they should have taken that into account when writing this ending. That's what I was saying.
Yeah, they absolutely should have. Although, I definitely have played Left 4 Dead and Left 4 Dead 2. And the idea of a Half-Life game in that engine is a super exciting idea. I love the Left 4 Dead engine.
Yeah, it looks good. It looks good. I actually wouldn't want one newer. Like, when I look at today's games, like the really cutting-edge stuff from today, I kind of almost don't want to see that level of photorealism on Alex Vance or Eli Kleiner. I kind of like them in their slightly retro cartoonish. To a certain extent, if you make them too detailed, they feel like a different character from a different genre. And so, but yeah, I would love to see them in like the Left 4 Dead. I think that would be a great spot on the tech curve for the next game, if they ever made it, which they apparently aren't.
No, I don't think they are. But I agree. A great deal of the character of the Half-Life universe is due to that kind of I guess cartoony is the way to describe it. It and I don't mean that as a pejorative, but it is kind of cartoony, exaggerated, and that's just kind of the Half-Life universe. I would not want to see that rendered like Call of Duty 17 or whatever
right.
They're up to now.
That would feel weird. Yeah,
and frankly, I don't want to see a head crab in that realistic. No thanks.
So I think it was it last year, 2017, that Mark Laidlaw published Epistle 3. And that was his... Yeah, I think it was 2017, or maybe I'm just old and I lose track of time. Anyway, for me, it feels recent. But Mark Laidlaw, the writer of the Half-Life series, left Valve. So they're definitely not making more Half-Life games. And so he released it, but he did it in this weird coded way where he called it, instead of Episode 3, he called it Epistle 3, and he gender-flipped all the characters. I guess to avoid pissing off Valve or to give himself plausible deniability. I'm not sure why he did that. But this was his roadmap for what Episode 3 would have been. And I know you read it, and I'm curious for your thoughts on it.
Well, I did. I read the original, and then I read the what did they call it? The translated version or corrected version? Yeah, that's what it was. Somebody put out a corrected version, right?
Where they just put all the names back so you could follow it, right? Right.
Exactly, which is much easier when you're reading it out loud. Because I did a video where I read it out loud. And I didn't want to have to do the translation of the names in my head. The only thing I actually didn't like about the translated version is the fact that they changed epistle to episode, which makes sense, I suppose. But I think he picked epistle 3 because he wrote it as a letter from Gordon Freeman to us.
Right, right, right.
And it loses something when you take away calling it epistle, at least I thought so. But I'm a nerdy English major who has studied things like epistolary novels, so I might be a little bit biased. But overall, I really, really loved it. There were some beautiful paragraphs in particular, and again, I'm biased because I just love his writing in general. I was a fan of Mark Laidlaw's novels way before I played Half-Life. I didn't even know that he had written it when I started playing it. But there are some passages in there that are just vintage Laidlaw, so beautiful. And I also just love the fact that if it couldn't end with a video game, I love the fact that Gordon Freeman finally has a voice. We get to hear what he sounds like. If not out loud, we at least get to hear right. what his voice is.
His authorial exactly. voice, or whatever you want to call it, his writing style. I'm glad Gordon Freeman didn't turn out to be inarticulate and have bad spelling.
Oh God, that would have been awful. No, he actually sounded like, to me, there was a lot of Isaac Kleiner in his voice, actually, I thought. He sounded like a much less harebrained Kleiner, which I thought was perfect since he worked with Kleiner, you know.
Sure, and they're both physicist nerds, yeah, so that fits.
But I thought it brought some pretty good closure to the story overall. And again, it actually kind of hilariously ends on a pretty damn big cliffhanger. Like, it ends on a huge cliffhanger, but not an emotional one.
I forget,
one.
What is it? Right, right. But what was the cliffhanger at the end? I forget.
Oh, well,
I read
so,
it, but it's been months.
Sure, sure, sure. Well, the way it ends, you know, Gordon, Alex, and Mossman have taken control of the Borealis, and Alex wants, and Judith wants to salvage it and basically let the rebels study it, but Alex wants to destroy it because that's what she promised her father, and their plan, and her plan, her slash Gordon's plan, is to basically take the Borealis and ram it into the heart of the Combine Empire, which is one of the places the Borealis is phasing in and out between, is a Combine outpost that has, like, you know, it's like a central point where they branch out and invade all different worlds. And so Alex wants to kamikaze the Borealis into that, and Judith wants to save it. Then Alex shoots Judith and kills her. And so the decision is kind of made. So Alex and Gordon, like, you know, they're going to go full, we're going to sacrifice ourselves for the greater good. And, you know, push it in full speed straight towards the Combine. And G-Man shows up. And Alex recognizes him. And G-Man basically says, come on, my dear, we've got places to go and things to do. And she goes with him and leaves Gordon by himself on this ship that's about to self-destruct. And then the Vortigaunts, just in time, pull Gordon out so he doesn't die in the explosion. And there's a beautiful paragraph where when just before the Vorts pull him out, when he thinks he's going to die, Gordon realizes that there is literally no way that humanity can stand against the Combine, because this ship that's probably the greatest weapon and the most damage they could possibly do is like a mosquito compared to the size of this place that he's trying to attack, and it's not even going to register when it explodes. And so basically all of this has been for nothing. And that's when the Vorts pull him out. And then there's a final wind-up paragraph where he basically says, you know, I'm not going to have any impact on the rebellion anymore. I believe that the spirit of a rebellion still exists, but no thanks to me. And this is the last you're ever going to hear of me, so Gordon Freeman signing out. That's where Half-Life 3 ends.
And you know what? That is a cliffhanger I can deal with. Because it's not this, I mean, it's the end of Gordon's story. All right. The arc of Half-Life. I mean, I wouldn't mind if he just defeated them, saved the world, and went home a hero. I would have been okay with that too. But this is fine too. It keeps with the style that Laidlaw wants to do, where it always ends with the hero just being flung from one ridiculous misadventure to another. So you feel like the adventure never ends. And that was fine. I'm fine with all of that. It felt distinctly correct in a way that I don't think other art authors would have trouble hitting that same tone, if you know what I mean. You could bring in some other good author, and they might write a good story that we'd all enjoy, but it wouldn't feel quite like Half-Life, because Mark Laidlaw really has his own thing going. And I think it's hard to imitate.
I would agree. I think it's pretty impossible to imitate, especially, and I think if they had another... If they brought in another writer, they probably wouldn't even attempt this. But I think especially that almost Lovecraftian feeling of, oh my God, I've seen past the veil. I've seen how hopeless everything is. Everything is meaningless. And yet everything I've done has mattered. He's one of the few people I know who can strike that balance so, so well.
Yeah. It's a shame we won't get to play that game. But I'm curious how you felt about it. Did you feel better about the game having read the narrative of what the game would have been? Because I found it kind of comforting.
I found it very comforting as well. If only so my mind, as difficult as it is to imagine Alex abandoning Gordon to leave with G-Man, I'd much rather that, and I'm sure Gordon would much rather that too, than leave her sobbing over her father's corpse. You know, I don't know where she is or what she's doing now, but at least it's not that.
Right, right. Well, she's probably wherever Gordon Freeman went at the end of Half-Life 1. You know, the hammer space for main characters. this nothing space.
Oh my God.
With...
I never even... considered that that's where he had taken her.
That's what I figure. He just puts her in the fridge with all these action heroes that he collects and then throws them into dangerous situations when the time comes. That's, I guess, I always imagine, that might be my headcanon, but that's how I imagined he operated.
No, that headcanon makes total sense. The way that I actually imagined it, because the, between episode 2 and epistle 3, I really got the sense that G-Man doesn't really care about Gordon for Gordon's sake at all, and that he was basically just a means to get to and to protect Alex. That's kind of the vibe that I got. And so my read... turned into, after reading Epistle 3, my read all the way back to the original Half-Life was that whatever that moment was on the Borealis that G-Man snatched her away from, or, you know, took her away to, that's why he put Gordon in cold storage or whatever he did. He did that to save him for Half-Life 2 so that he could escort Alex and make sure she would survive to that moment, whatever it was and whatever reason it was important to him. I never considered that maybe he just put her on ice too.
Right. And that I kind of even imagined that he was like, oh, this is an upgrade. Okay, that Gordon guy was good, but this one's better.
Yeah. I like that. That's so G-Man.
Right, and he just tosses Gordon out and is like, oh, I have a new main agent of chaos. And future games might be played from Alex's point of view.
I love it. I love that.
And we got to get her an HEV suit, though.
I think part of the point is she doesn't need one.
Yeah, it's true. She tanks all that damage. Gordon tanks all that damage, but he's wearing a super suit. She's just got that leather jacket. I don't know what that thing's made of, but that thing is sturdy.
Yeah, not stalker-proof, though.
No.
I was so... God, I have never been more angry at a video game than when that stalker stabbed her. Oh, my God. I thought she was going to die.
You're talking about the hunter.
Hunter, not stalker. My bad. Yeah. I meant hunter.
They do. Yeah.
I seriously thought she was going to die there, and oh, man.
Me too.
Killing
Me too.
Alex would have been the one thing. Oh, no. No messing with Alex. Not allowed.
Yeah. And even if Valve wanted to come back to this now, Robert Culp is dead. That's the voice of Breen. And there is always a fan theory that he could still be alive because he died in a teleporter explosion. But... I wouldn't have liked to undo the ending of Half-Life 2, but there was that theory that he could still be alive. But he has since died, and Robert Guillaume has died. That's the voice of Eli, but of course, yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, Eli himself is dead. That's true. Yeah. But now they can't even, if they wanted to do a flashback or a recorded message or something from Eli, You can't do it. He's gone.
Yeah, and Breen, at least according to Epistle 3, Breen is alive, but he's in the body of one of the slug creatures.
Overseer, yeah.
Overseer. Someday I will remember the name. Someday.
Yeah, well,
yeah,
he's
in the body of an overseer now.
They're all doers. They're all thing doers. An overseer, a stalker, a hunter. Nothing's
That's a
like
good point.
A mech. Yeah.
That's really true. They are all verbs that do very specific things. They hunt, they stalk, they oversee. Huh. They combine. They combine things. Damn.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I love Mark Laidlaw so much.
So the next question is, and this isn't really something either of us can answer, but why can't Valve count to three? This is just such a weird thing that they make. Let me give the full list here. We've got Half-Life 2, Portal 2, Left 4 Dead 2, Team Fortress 2. And... none of them got a follow-up.
Even
Episode 2. But we didn't get a follow-up, even though every single one of those games was an even bigger hit than the one that preceded it. You have the first game that's a great idea with a rough presentation. The second game is this perfection of the idea that everyone loves and wants to see what happens next. And then... then they're done. They're like, yeah, we already made the games, so we're done. And they don't make any more. And that's weird.
Well, I mean, Lord knows I don't work for Valve. But from what I've heard of their their work culture, and at least what's evident in their credits. Because I've noticed that the credits of the game don't call out, you know, it's just an alphabetical list of employees. It's not, you know, right. This person does this. The only people they do that for are the actors. You know, this guy is the voice of Alex, you know, and so on. But for the actual Valve employees, there's not like, this is the programmer, this is the, you know, designer, you know. No, it's all just completely alphabetical, including even Gabe Newell is in there just under N, you know.
Right.
So,
right.
And my understanding is that they don't actually get told, or at least didn't back in the day, get told what to work on. Or at least there was a big chunk of their time that they were allowed to work on whatever they want. And I'll say this for Valve, they've proven through their games that they are absolutely consummate artists. They are a game company that is all about art. You know, whether it's storytelling art, assets art, design art, like, they are an art house game company. And my experience with artists is they get bored really quick doing the same thing.
Yeah. So
part of me is like, maybe, okay, we did the first one, that's interesting. Okay, now let's make it better. Okay, it's better. Do we want to do that again? Nah, let's go do something else. Or it's either that or there's feature creep, where it's, okay, Half-Life 3 is going to be a fully immersive virtual reality world. How do we do that? I don't know, but I don't have a boss telling me what to do, so let's go figure out how to code VR.
Right.
Or some combination of the two, maybe, but I mean, this is all speculation based on what little I know.
Yeah, that actually sounds very true. This is what you get when you give artists a bunch of freedom and say, go make something cool. They will, but then they have trouble turning it into a product that you can keep pumping out year after year. And that would be fine if the only time that really is a problem is in the specific case of Half-Life 3, because it, or Half-Life Episode 2, because it ends in this unsatisfying way. Portal 2 does not demand a follow-up. In fact, it ends satisfactorily. I was fine with the Portal. In fact, I would be irritated if somebody tried to make more Portal. If somebody, like, tried to re-imprison Chell and have, you know, another crazy robot try to make her do puzzles again. I felt like, okay, we've seen all the wonderful ideas. This world is complete. I'm happy that they moved on. It's a wonderful game, but it doesn't demand more. Same thing for Left 4 Dead. I don't think there's any there's not anything to refine or any more that needs to be done. Anything you add from here is going to be cruft.
And if they worked for if this was EA, by now we would have Left 4 Dead New York, Left 4 Dead San Francisco, Left 4 Dead London, Left 4 Dead Brazil.
Yes.
Like, you know, and
you're absolutely right.
And of the two, as much as the ending of Episode 2 hurt, if I have to choose, I'll choose what Valve gave us over what someone like EA gives us any day of the week. I will take the art house who screws up sometimes but makes something beautiful in the process.
The perfect, you give us that one perfect game rather than 8 years of shovelware of just banging out the door the same thing as last time, only with more shouting and, you know, bigger, louder marketing.
I think this last 30 seconds of conversation has done more to make me forgive Valve than anything I've thought about in the last month or so.
Oh, can you imagine what EA would have done with Gordon Freeman by now?
Oh,
he looked like Marcus Fien- He'd look like Marcus Fenix by now. He'd have a dead wife. No, yeah, he'd have a dead wife, and by now you'd have a little girl that you'd be doing the dad game thing, since that's hot right now. So you'd have a little girl that's following you around doing story stuff, and you'd have to keep saving her.
He would have, Alex would have turned into his love interest, is exactly what would have happened.
Yeah. Ugh. And then they would have sidelined her, because...
Oh, obviously.
She needs to stay home with the kid or whatever. So that's sidelines Alex.
Or gone the Wolfenstein route, and, pregnant Alex running around with a rocket launcher.
Right. Oh. Yeah, I can just imagine what... And they would have started voicing Gordon Freeman by now... And he'd be voiced by Nolan North.
I was just going to say, yep.
And he would just have badass military dialogue, even though he's a physicist. But then every once in a while, he'd have some mangled physics, you know, lingo thrown into his dialogue as a half-hearted attempt at characterization. And it would just be painful.
Did I mention I went to MIT?
Yeah, he'd always mention MIT. Never show any knowledge of what you might learn at MIT, but he would mention that he went there a lot. And you'd be fighting a lot more human enemies. Like, it would just be...
Yes.
A lot more human enemies. A lot less of that weird... Oh, the art style on all of the non-humanoid foes in the Half-Life games are just so excellent. All of them have that weird, organic... They all feel like they belong to the same thing. They're not just weird designs. And they're not just, hey, it's like a robot. But it's like a bug, but also a robot with a laser on it. It's like, a Strider is a really interesting... Same thing with the Hunter. Those are really striking designs. And if the artist who made those made another... thing, you would probably be able to recognize it without context. You'd be able to look at it and go, I'll bet that belongs to the Combine, because their style was so strong.
Absolutely. And even the humanoid enemies, not that you would think about it if you treat, you know, because obviously the story is really kind of, it's there in Half-Life 2 if you want it, but they're not going to shove it down your throat. They're not going to make you think about their story if you don't want to.
Right, right.
But if you do, even the humanoid enemies, I mean, the Metro cops are one thing, but the Combine soldiers, we know what's under those suits. We see it in the trains.
Oh, yeah.
That's horrifying.
What are those guys called? I think they're another thing doer.
Oh, I can't remember. You know, I've always just called them Combine soldiers, but they might actually have have their own name.
Yeah, there is one. In episode one, there's one that keeps, like, Alex is trying to lower a force field, and he keeps putting the force field back up, and she goes, oh, there's a blank. Well, someone in the comments below... Tell me what I'm forgetting.
Oh, those things. Right. I was thinking of the soldiers who are those things in suits, but you're right. I know exactly what you're talking about. They do have their own name. And Google would tell me, but I don't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, you're right. The comments, I'm sure, will have 6 or 7 people telling us what they are.
A gunship isn't a thing doer. That's more of a traditional name, gunship.
No, although it is a very solid description. It's a ship with a gun.
Yes.
This is a Hunter. This is a Strider. It fits with the naming convention, although, gunship is a normal kind of military thing.
Stalker.
It still fits.
Yeah.
Stalker. Oh, right. Stalkers. That's what they are. Stalker.
Yeah. Stalker, and then Strider is the big thing on the tall legs, and then Hunter is the thing that stabbed Alex.
Right. Right. And then Metro Cops, and I don't think the Combine soldiers actually have a name themselves other than just soldiers, do they?
Gary. I don't think they do. I think the player base called the White Ones the Elite Soldiers, but I think that's because of the name of the character model in the game. I don't think that's ever acknowledged as the name within the story.
Right, and they are definitely the leveled up version of the soldiers, so that makes sense.
So, the regular Combine, the regular Combine soldier could easily be called, you know, a suppressor by the Combine, and that we just happen to never know that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I like this idea that they're all thing doers.
I do too. I never thought of that. And that is such a brilliant observation. I love that so much.
And the first time you meet a Combine soldier, going back to their art style, the first time you meet one of those guys with the gas mask face and the glowing eyes, that was actually scary. Like, survival horror, holy shit, what is this thing? It's when you come out of the mines and you walk down the train tracks, I believe. That's your first encounter with the Combine soldiers, I believe.
Which ones now? You mean the elite guys? Or
No, just the... I think that was your first meeting with Combine soldiers. Just the guys in black armor.
Before that, it was Metro Cops. Right. I think you're right. I think you're entirely right. It's just when you come out of the mines and you see one for the first time.
Right, as you're, like, going through a couple of train cars and... I think the game expected me to be excited about the new gun, but I was like, holy cow, who are these freaks? These guys are out there. And really, there's nothing... I don't know why their design works so well. I mean, there's a lot of other games that have guys with, you know, face masks to, you know, make them as other as possible, to dehumanize them as much as possible. So I don't know why the ones in Half-Life 2 work so well. It might just be because... I hadn't seen that kind of thing before, and now we've seen it a million times, but the first one always sticks with you. But yeah, I remember them as being just a really strong design and alarming. And then, they actually turned out to be cannon fodder, but they were scary at first, especially when you meet one of those shotgun guys and they wreck your day.
Oh, yeah, those red eyes, man. You know shit's about to go down when you see one of those red eye guys in your face. You know, though, as much as I love the soldiers, the Metro Cops were always my very favorite design and favorite enemy. I think it's because I just love the super dystopic 1984 feel of the first, like, 20 minutes of the game, like, before you actually get a weapon at all. I love it so much. It's what sold me on, like, because I played through the first game and that was fine, but that first 20 minutes sold me on the new Half-Life universe so hard. And I love the idea that these Metro Cops are just poor bastards who got recruited by the Combine just so they could get food. And they're doing these awful, horrible things.
Right.
Oh, it's just such a great little bit of... There's such a great story.
I have to admit, I ruined the Metro Cops for myself.
How?
Back when I used to write for The Escapist, I did a comic for them. And one of the recurring jokes I had was I had this late night talk show. Sometimes I had comedy. Sometimes I had jokes I wanted to make that would have worked better as stand up. And there's no good way to do that. You know, where you just need one character to say several funny things. And you can't do that in your typical two guys on a couch type webcomic. And I was like, well, what if I made a literal character doing stand-up, who could I use? Well, I've got Gary's mod here. Oh, I'll use Wallace Breen, and I'll have him hosting a show called After Curfew. and he tells the jokes like Johnny Carson, and then he's got his side, you know, his sidekick character, the Ed McMahon, I'm dating myself here, character.
It's okay. I remember Ed McMahon.
Yeah. Good. I'm glad somebody does. But the sidekick character was a Metro cop who was just called Metro. And I played him very much against type. I mean, he was a fascist bully who talked about, you know, his beating quotas and things. But he was also a diehard Nintendo fan and a super weeaboo. And that was the character I came up. And Metro was actually kind of the smarter of the two. And in my version of this show, Breen was a guy who only seemed funny because people wrote jokes for him. And I really liked these two goofy-ass stolen characters that I came up with. But now when I see a Metro cop, I think of my Metro, the goofy-ass weeaboo who's really into Minecraft.
I loved those comics so much. Oh,
I lost. I built a whole TV set. Here's a bit of behind the scenes. The whole after curfew thing. I went into Hammer, the world's worst level editor. I'm not even joking. It is abominable. But I made an entire TV set. There was the desk area, rows of seats. There was you know, the stage. Everything you would need. And then there was even backstage areas that I used for some jokes. And I built all of that. And then in a computer migration, I forgot to back it up. And I lost it.
Oh.
And it's gone forever.
Oh, that's so painful.
I've often thought, oh, I should bring those back. Those were so good and so much fun to do. And on one hand, I'm not sure how the escapist would be. I wouldn't call it stolen pixels, but I'd definitely be reusing these characters I made. But they were characters I already stole from someone else, so I'd be re-stealing them for myself. And there's just too many layers of ambiguity there. And then the entire stage, or the entire set is gone, so I'd have to rebuild that. And yeah, I always get sad when I think of that.
Oh, that's such a shame. You know, for some reason, Stolen Pixels and Concerned, I suppose they should have ruined Metro Cops for me, because it's so, you know, because they become the butt of so many wonderful jokes. But I think my first impression of them was so blown away and so terrified of these guys that were just shoving me around and hitting me with freaking billy clubs. Like,
right.
God, that even as they're the butt of jokes, I can't ever look at one that's not in specifically like the context of a comic. I can't ever just look at a picture of one and go, Metro. I always go, oh God, I don't have a soda can, I promise.
Oh, yeah, that was a strong start to a game. That was, you know, you wonder, how are they going to, everybody used to talk about the tram ride being this gold standard of how you introduce a video game world. How could they possibly top that? And they did. And I don't know how anybody could top that. How could anybody top the first 15 minutes of Half-Life 2? It was such a powerful start to the game.
It is. I'm not sure it's possible. Quite honestly, to this day, that's like, I mean, at the risk of sounding ridiculous, that's like the to be or not to be of video game design. Like, yeah, you can maybe live up to it.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, it's just, it doesn't get more brilliant than that 15 to 20 minutes. Like, it just, it doesn't, and you could spend hours picking it apart and analyzing why, but at the end of the day, it's like To Be or Not to Be, or Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. It's lightning in a bottle. And ultimately, you just kind of have to just be happy you were there to enjoy it, you know?
think of how much that sequence trusted the player. At no point does anybody stop and explain, okay, Gordon, it's been this many years. Here's who the Combine are. Here's what they're doing. Here's their goals. Here's how people are reacting. We have a resistance movement. These are the members. Nobody stops and explains it to you. And people complain. It's like, oh, how come Gordon Freeman doesn't ask any of these questions? And it's because the writer trusts you to be able to fill in the blanks. And no game would do that today. They'd always want to, like, either lock you in place while somebody spends 2 minutes giving you the Wikipedia article on the previous game, or they would, you know, give you a voiceover before the start of the game to explain the premise. And Half-Life 2 just drops you in cold and says, you're smart, player. You'll figure this out. You know a dystopia when one punches you in the face. We don't need to tell you that the Combine are bad, because you can see it if we just shut up and let you experience the world. And other games don't do that, and they all feel the need to explain themselves, over-explain themselves. And I think that's one of the most powerful things about that first thing, that intro to me, is just how much it trusts you to understand the world simply by looking at it, without needing for the author to, like, step in and say, there's a few things I want you to know before you begin playing my video game.
Absolutely. And it puts you, it makes you feel so close to Gordon. At least it did for me. Like, of course Gordon doesn't ask these questions. He doesn't have time to ask questions. He randomly warps in from, you know, having no consciousness whatsoever, warps in on a train in some random dystopia in the future, starts getting punched by people he doesn't understand. Everybody around him is terrified. Somebody grabs him, shoves him into a room. It's Barney. What? It's what? Okay, I have to go out that window? Okay, oh, fuck, there's a train coming. Ah, people are shooting at me. Like, he doesn't have time to ask questions, and neither does the player.
Right.
You just go, and the questions, the answers come later, but you get thrown in headfirst with him and are confused and terrified with him. Like, there's almost no emotional separation between you and the character. It's not the writer saying, you should feel bad for Gordon because he's really confused and he doesn't know where he is now. He doesn't have to tell you that because you feel that too.
Right. Right. And, you know, I don't need Nolan North's voice coming out of my head going, somebody tell me what's going on. Who are you people? No, I already know how to feel in this situation. I'm good. I'm already my emotions are already consonant with this scene. I don't need the writer to insert dialogue here. Yeah, it's so good.
He let you be Gordon's inner monologue is what the writer did there, and it was perfect.
Although to a certain extent, you're not so much, oh, who are these people? What's going on? It's always like, you want me to pick up that soda can? It's going to feel so good in 10 minutes when I start shooting you assholes.
Once you've played it, yes. Not the first time.
Even then, you kind of know as a video gamer, all right, I'm going to get to shoot some of these guys pretty soon. This isn't my first video game.
That's fair. Although, I gotta say, when I got to that scene for the first time, that wasn't my reaction. I also wasn't scared of him. I was angry.
Yeah.
Like, just out of character. Yeah, I was like, you want me to pick up? Oh, you son of a bitch, freaking taking people away from their families. I'm gonna... And then I threw the can at him and got my ass whipped.
But just think, if Gordon's voice had floated out of your speakers and his, you know, you were angry and if he was scared, then there would have immediately been dissonance for you. And it would have launched you out of the game because you're like, no, that's not how I'm feeling. I'm angry. I'm not scared. Or if you get there and you are kind of nervous and scared and you're like, oh, Gordon's angry. I guess he's an angry psychopath. Is that who I'm playing? But if they leave the character quiet, then just your thoughts are his thoughts. And you're always consonant with the game world. And I love it. Stop saying silent protagonists are old, an old idea. They're wonderful.
Yes, they're love letting it. You be the protagonist. You should like that when it's done well.
Yeah, that's it, when it's done well.
Yeah, I guess it's an easy thing to fall back on, just not writing dialogue and say, silent protagonist. That's easy enough to do. But yeah, Half-Life did it right.
It's not enough to give a silent protagonist and let the player make up their own emotions. You have to put them in situations where they will feel emotions. And that's not easy to do.
Players
are smart. And they've seen a lot of movies and video games, and they know all your tricks. And they're not going to just, here's some kid. Now be sick. He's dead now. Feel bad.
Right. You know, that worked, honestly, even in the first Half-Life, though. They certainly didn't put you in as specific a situation as Half-Life 2 does. You know, hey, you're in a dystopia with a bunch of bullies around. You know, it's a little bit more open-ended than that. But letting your, not giving the character a reaction to contradict yours is, when you have the writing to back that up, is so brilliant. Because, like, I remember the first time I ran into the giant tentacle creature that's growing out of the rocket silo in the original Half-Life.
Oh, right, the one that was based on sound. Yeah.
Yeah, and when it initially breaks through and eats the guy, obviously that's a jump moment. But other than that, I was completely fascinated by that thing. Like, I spent an embarrassing amount of time, like, throwing grenades and making noise or being really quiet so it would get close to me so I could look at it, and was just fascinated by it. And I'm so glad, like you said, I didn't have no one north going, well, I'm going to burn down this thing, or, oh God, that thing is so terrifying. No, it just let me do what I wanted to do and feel how I felt.
Right, you're walking around the catwalk looking at it, and you've been there for about 2 minutes, and some timer goes off inside the game logic, and suddenly your radio buddy gets on there. Hey, it's sensitive to sound. You're going to want to be quiet, Gordon. And then 30 seconds later, you're going to want to be careful not to make any noise, Gordon. That thing will get you if it hears you. And then 30 seconds later, Gordon, keep this sound down.
Have you seen, it's not Errant Signal.
Freeman's Mind?
God, I can't. No, not Freeman's Mind. It's not even that. But there is a video that somebody did on Mega Man X, Mega Man 10. And
about its brilliant opening and how it teaches you the mechanics?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I can't remember that either. I saw that. It was really good. It was really good.
But you know
the
video that I mean, right?
Yeah,
Mega Man, come in. Yeah,
yes.
That one.
Oh, that is so brilliant. I will figure out what that is and link it in the comments below.
Absolutely should. If Ego Raptor, that's his name. Ego Raptor. He has like three really brilliant videos. He has one on Castlevania that's really good too, but completely not relevant to this conversation. But the one on Mega Man 10 absolutely is. It's all about letting the game teach you and lead you, as opposed to explaining to you what you need to do.
Yeah. Well, Brittany, I hope this has been a good session for you. I hope you've done some healing.
I have very much. I think I've actually officially forgiven Valve.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. Thanks so much for coming on again, talking about this stuff. I am so glad this is still relevant to you, so somebody will talk about it with me.
Always, always a pleasure, and always happy to talk about it.
Okay, Thanks again. Thanks for listening, everybody. Bye.
Goodbye.